Hello, welcome back to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition's podcast, AJCN and Press. And it is that time of year. We need a little Christmas music or holiday music in here because we have both Dr. Deirdre Tobias and Dr. Christopher Duggan back on the podcast for our yearly AJCN in Review podcast. Do you both want to say hi?
Kevin, hello. As always. It's a pleasure. It's an annual thing we do now. It's great.
I know. And hopefully we'll do it next year.
A tradition.
Right on time. Definitely not recording 2 weeks before Christmas or anything. So So this year, what do we think about how HSCN went? Any reflections anybody wants to offer? I know, Chris, you've got some metrics.
Well, it's always helpful to have data, Kevin, as you know. And it's been a great year for the AJCN. We're on target for about 1,400 submissions, which is really quite a nice number. It's a little bit off the COVID-induced peak when people were staying at home and writing papers to the tune of about 1,600 submissions a couple years ago, but it's well within our historic numbers, and we're happy with that. We also were happy to receive an upgrade in our dreaded impact factor. The dreaded impact factor has gone up to 8.5 or so for the AJCN this year. So that's really an impressive number for a subspecialty journal like ours, and indeed is a historic high. So if you track those things, if you put importance on them, it's better to be high than low. So we're happy with that. There have been two new sections introduced to the journal this past calendar year. Well, perhaps one really got off the ground, and Joel Mason, associate editor from Tufts University, has started a really exciting section called Updates from Federal Colleagues. And in this section, our colleagues who work for NIH or USDA or CDC or even the White House are given some space in the journal to introduce our readers to new policies, new programs, requests for applications, et cetera, that they will be championing in the weeks to months ahead. And so that's really, I think, an exciting development. New associate editor Nancy Krebs from the University of Colorado is poised to develop another new section entitled Nutrition for the Practicing Clinician that will be rolled out sometime in 2023. And as the title implies, that will be case vignettes and kind of a question and answer back and forth discussion about difficult diagnostic or therapeutic dilemmas in the field of clinical nutrition. So we're really excited for that to be to come down the pike. And in closing, I will just say that 2023, all of the ASN journals are being transitioned to a new publisher. As of January 1st, Elsevier will be our publishing house, and we're looking forward to that transition.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been an exciting year. I'm looking forward to the C getting a lot more emphasis in the AJCN as Dr. Krebs comes on and really beefs up the clinical part of things. And definitely want to highlight that for any students who are in dietetics or medicine or any of the allied healthcare professions that look out for that. And definitely it'll be a good learning opportunity for folks thinking critically about clinical nutrition.
Kevin, I should have also mentioned, of course, it goes without saying, but of course, your six podcasts over the year have been a true highlight, emphasizing interviews with a wide range of scientists who've contributed studies to our pages. And I would encourage everyone to put that on your podcast playlist, because you really learn a lot about the rationale for the studies, the difficulties that the studies were faced with sometimes, and implications for the science. So they're really fun interviews to listen to.
Yeah, trying to humanize the scientific process. I know we all put a little bit of lipstick on a pig when we put a manuscript together, and it's nice to hear about the pig's journey prior to.
The way the sausage is made, if you will.
Yes, or the plant-based meat alternative sausage, which we'll probably get into here. How about you, Dee Dee? Any reflections on the past year?
No, I feel like it's been maybe picking back up to the pre-COVID pace, and I am looking forward to seeing what the new publisher brings. I did see that we put out a call for applications for your position, Kevin. So it is a little bit sad to think of you transitioning to a different role in the journal, or but also exciting to bring on someone new, possibly for the podcast or other aspects of your work. But I think you've done a really good job establishing this position over the last couple of years and this year in particular. So I look forward to seeing who applies and what candidates we get. But we'll certainly miss the interactions with you in this role, although you're not going too far, hopefully.
Yes, I am. I'm very sad to learn I'm no longer young, so this is the official demarcation.
That's pretty much why we were forced into sending out a call for application. No, I'm just kidding.
Speaking of pre-COVID activities, it's really exciting to know that the American Society for Nutrition will be meeting in person in my hometown of Boston, July 23rd, 24th, 25th, 2023. So listeners should circle those dates. The abstract site is now open, I think, for submissions even. So looking forward to seeing everyone there.
Yeah, so all those manuscripts you're going to submit to AJCN, send in that abstract beforehand, come chat with us, and be happy to give you some critical feedback beforehand.
Can't hurt.
And vice versa, if you submit to ASN and not sure where your abstract might find a home, consider AJCN. I know we often request to look through the scores, or at least, the oral and poster presentations to see what good science is coming out of those conferences. So we'd be happy to consider your paper in the journal.
Tweet about it, and Didi will definitely comment on it and invite you to submit to AJCN. I think we've had a couple publications from that, right?
Yes, absolutely.
If Twitter still exists then, but we'll go down that route. Awesome. Well, we are going to do, I guess, what we do every year, maybe a slightly abridged from past years, but we're going to chat about our top AJCN 2022 alt metrics and our top cited articles as well. So we had, I think, 15 alt metric scores, and we're going to do the top 15 citations. But Dr. Duggan flagged a few extras that he thought was interesting on the top cited list. So yeah, what any broad reflections on these top 15 articles or things that either of you took away from it? These are the things that are essentially getting the most scholarly citations, but then also just the alt metric score sort of combines across all mentions across social media and whatnot. And it's kind of, this for me was interesting to see the shared similarities and differences between the citations versus alt metric scores.
Yeah, it's always hard to predict what papers excite scientific interest versus popular press interest. Sometimes it's a nice correlation, not always. What struck me really about all these papers, frankly, was the fact that the breadth of the scientific methods that people used to address important problems in nutrition, right? So, as you'll hear, that ranged from anywhere from observational cohort studies to randomized clinical trials to evaluations of so-called big data sets. So, I think it was a nice representation of the depth and breadth of science that we publish.
Any reflections, Dee?
Yeah, so I think most of the literature I tend to see as an editor is in the space of nutritional epidemiology, so the larger observational cohorts. As a lot of these data sets have become open access essentially for anyone to request or to put in proposals to be able to access and analyze data, it's fascinating how global certain cohorts have gotten in terms of, what data are being analyzed and submitted from. All the way across the world and in Asia, from UK Biobank data to other areas of Europe and South America, and NHANES data, for example, which is the national statistical data we have in the US. I probably see more non-US authors submitting NHANES data, and similarly for UK Biobank, UK groups publishing these data. So it's just fascinating how this accessibility and open access has really been taken advantage of in a good way, probably in a lot of sense. And then also just being able to, you know, get it in the hands of pretty much anywhere in the world is interesting. So I, you know, that's something that I've noted as a trend over the past year, for sure.
Yeah, the not-so-American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
The global American, right?
Yeah. Cool. So, Chris, I know, I think we're going to dive into maybe just review a couple, like, you know, a few of the studies that were in the top, but then I think we'll do a bit of a deep dive from both of you from your favorite papers. So definitely let us know why you wanted to highlight them specifically. I'm sure the authors will enjoy the call out. Don't be too critical. Post-publication peer review.
I think most of the criticism, presumably has been applied early on in the pre-acceptance phase. So yeah, there were a handful of papers. I can cite two of the ones that had to do with a very important topic, which is COVID. Perhaps you've heard about it. It's a global pandemic, and there's many papers that suggest there might be a nutritional role either in susceptibility or in even therapeutics to COVID infection. So Dr. Alan Fernandez wrote a paper called The Effect of Single High-Dose Vitamin D3 on Cytokines, Chemokines, and Growth Factor in Patients with Moderate to Severe COVID-19. And Dr. Sridhar Subramanian and colleagues wrote a paper called Vitamin D Binding Protein, Free Vitamin D and COVID-19 Mortality in Hospitalized Patients. So not surprisingly, both of these papers were well described in the lay literature because of the importance of the topic in today's global world.
So you think vitamin D is settled?
Settled or subtle?
Well, subtle might get at what some of the results were. So what were the major takeaways, at least from the science that we published in vitamin D and COVID?
Oh, sure. Well, obviously, the Fernandez paper was interesting both from a methodologic and substantive basis, because indeed it was a so-called secondary analysis paper. A previous paper by this group had been published in another journal where the primary outcomes were length of stay. And their large primary outcome randomized trial of very high dose, 200,000 international units of vitamin D3 versus placebo, showed no difference in length of stay in a group of patients with moderate to severe COVID infections. But in a very kind of well-planned approach, the authors in, I should note, their clinical trial registration document specified secondary, what I would call immunologic and biochemical outcomes. And that's what the topic of this paper was, which was, did vitamin D3 supplementation affect a large variety of serum cytokines, growth factors, and total white blood cell count in their original cohort? And it's out that perhaps, as you might expect, in the absence of a clinically significant effect of vitamin D, there wasn't even a sense that vitamin D supplementation had an effect on these wide variety of cytokines. There was a hint that granulocyte macrophage colonizing stimulating factor was altered by vitamin D supplementation, but the authors also did a nice job of correcting for multiple comparisons, because as you can imagine, there was a whole long list of cytokines that were studied with the effect of vitamin D supplementation versus placebo. So my really take-home message is that if you're going to put the time and effort to do a randomized clinical trial and you have a variety of secondary outcomes, please list those secondary outcomes a priori on your clinical trials registry site. When you write such a secondary outcomes paper, be very upfront that these are indeed secondary outcomes and try not to pass them off as primary outcomes. And obviously, really consider correcting for multiple comparisons, because we often see that issue for its papers that are submitted to us with a single or multiple dietary exposure and multiple health or laboratory outcomes. And the authors often don't correct for multiple comparisons, as Fernandez and colleagues did. So a great paper that I think lends biological credence to their primary paper of no substantial effect.
Yeah, and I had looked up in that one, because anytime you see a null finding in the vitamin D literature, the first question is, well, what was their vitamin D status at baseline and what did they achieve? And, you know, I think there were or depending on which guidelines and ranges you follow as far as repleteness of vitamin D status, they were relatively well nourished, 20 nanograms per mil, 25 hydroxy D at baseline. So depending on where you fall and thinking about what the optimal vitamin D status is, I'm not too surprised that it was a negative outcome there.
Right. Well, that brings up the point of, are you treating a nutritional deficiency or are you giving a hormonally and immunologically active component to your diet, which is the classic double-edged sword of vitamin D supplementation. You do point out, yes, the mean vitamin D did go from 21.1 to 44.6 in the vitamin D recipients and essentially stayed the same in placebo recipients, lending some credibility that the intervention was as planned.
Yeah, it's a never-ending topic for the vitamin D world of how do you I think nobody likes these single high dose, particularly when it's like extremely high dose interventions, and I think some of the meta-analyses do bear that out, that consistent lower dose supplementation has better outcomes than the really high single dose massive bolus like 50,000 plus IUs. So vitamin D continues to be a status by dose, by dosing schema, by subpopulation group, that everybody has a new hypothesis about why the trials have failed and how we need to refine them in the future.
You say fail, but I say gave a very interesting answer.
Exactly.
Well, we all want vitamin D to be the savior, right?
No, I think this, Chris, you mentioned that the primary versus secondary outcome registration, I think that is incredibly important for reigning in authors that might otherwise overstate their, more exploratory analyses. But it's amazing how headlines don't necessarily reflect those. And the, whether it's primary, secondary, adjusted for multiple comparison, that gets completely lost beyond the scientific readership.
Sure.
And, I think the overstating of outcomes is just too much nuance to educate when it comes, to disseminating these types of results, because you have to go through this whole discussion of what power means and, your a priori hypotheses versus postdoc findings and chance and all of those fun statistical considerations. But, I at the same time, I don't think people who have secondary hypotheses or revisit old data sitting around from a well-done randomized trial, I don't think they should, discount or discredit the possibility of defining something novel or exciting. I think these data can be used for many years to come and should. And researchers who are using these data more or less, post hoc, and maybe even you can use the word mining for new findings. Mm-hmm. It's good use of this existing data. And I think there's definitely a space for these post hoc analyses.
But indeed, that's
with this caveat of this is not what these data were intended for. It's probably the 1,000th result we've looked at this point and could be completely due to chance, but also is consistent with XYZ. So,
but indeed, that's the rationale for NIH encouraging researchers to post their data sets in publicly available sites, right? So that others can derive different hypotheses and do secondary analyses on those as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I like this trial design too, of having a primary outcome of a meaningful clinical endpoint and then the secondary outcomes being physiological intermediates, which like nutrition and maybe Didi, you'll get into this talking about surrogate outcomes, but often we have a link between a nutritional intervention and some sort of intermediate outcome that we try and extrapolate out what it would mean for a clinical endpoint. But this is it's nice to see the clinical endpoints or the physiological intermediates and cytokines, chemokines, et cetera, come after the fact that we've published that, hey, it didn't do anything for meaningful clinical endpoints that we care about. So what else besides vitamin D, Chris? Anything?
You don't want to hear my second story about vitamin D? It's an observational study.
We have another.
I just want to set you up for. I don't want to disappoint you, but it's not a trial. It's yet another observational study. But there were some really, I thought, important tweaks to this paper as well. And this paper was published, as I mentioned, by Dr. Subramanian and colleagues. And what they pointed out is that a lot of the observational studies previously on this topic have been plagued by the fact that people don't remember that vitamin D, because it's carried by albumin and vitamin D binding protein, could act as an acute phase response. And so measurements of quote unquote vitamin D deficiency might be more related to that phenomenon, that these people might have low vitamin D levels because albumin synthesis is declined, is lowered in the setting of acute infection. So what these groups did was they performed an observational cohort study among nearly 500 adults admitted in Liverpool, England, with COVID. And the mortality rate in the first 28 days was nearly 25%. So this is a pretty sick group of patients. And so they therefore were wanting to evaluate whether mortality risk changed with variabilities of vitamin D exposure. But the interesting thing is that the vitamin D exposure wasn't just limited to 25-hydroxy-D serum concentrations, but they actually calculated with taking into consideration vitamin D binding protein and albumin concentrations, both a free and a bioavailable vitamin D concentration. Basically, well, looking a little bit more at the science of whether the nutrient concentration was related to this phenomenon. And indeed, at baseline, about 58% of the cohort had a vitamin D level of less than 50 nanomoles per liter. They used 50 to 75 nanomoles per liter as their normal range. And then it gets a little tricky because, of course, then they start expressing vitamin D as an exposure variable and mortality as an outcome variable in a variety of different ways. So they looked at it on a univariate basis, on a bivariate basis, low versus high, on a categorical basis, on a continuous basis. And suffice to say, on a bivariate approach, there was really no difference in low vitamin D levels between those who survived and those who died. But if they evaluated categories of vitamin D concentration, using the 50 to 75 range as the quote normal range, those adults who had low levels, less than 25 nanomoles per liter, or high levels, greater than 100 nanomoles per liter, both had substantially increased risks of death than those with the normal vitamin D levels. There was no association between free and bioavailable vitamin D and mortality, however. So it was an interesting study that, as I mentioned, brought forth that method of estimating free and bioavailable vitamin D levels. But overall, the results did not seem to certainly support vitamin D supplementation as an approach to reduce mortality due to COVID.
The free hormone hypothesis makes its debut on AJCN in press. Yeah, this is I think is an interesting study that, you know, people say vitamin D and then have different definitions for what they actually mean. And there's been a lot of literature looking across physiological and pathophysiological states, the total 25-OHD, and then the different bound and unbound fractions and whether they're potentially more predictive. And I don't think it's worked out quite as well as everyone has wanted it to, but I agree that it does sort of support that if the free level really is the bioactive level and it's not predictive, then you probably have a high risk of confounding or reverse causality of the disease states influencing vitamin D. And it's just a marker of, you know, that physiological stress that comes with it rather than it is a causal intermediate. But
as the case for many nutrients, which are low yes. in the setting of infection or inflammation, right?
I know. I teach some of the nutrition status assessment classes for dietitians, and I'm just like, don't trust most of the values that you see in plasma. Even I think this is a really good 25-OHD is a really good example. I think of everybody wants, you know, quote unquote objective measures of dietary exposures and nutrition status, and they are as susceptible to other confounding variables like exercise and physiological stresses like being present in the ICU and metabolic stress, cachexia, et cetera, that it does. It's not this like deterministic indicator of just vitamin D status, but many things converge on that, these nutritional status biomarkers, and make them not as useful as we'd like them to be. But everybody loves to correct a value and see lab numbers go up in the clinic. And I know there's
right.
resistance.
Exactly.
It's just so nice to see one thing improve when nothing else is improving. But is it really an improvement is always the question.
Don't forget, biomarkers in observational studies and even in trials can still be confounded. There are a lot of conceptions, misconceptions that if you only had an objective biomarker of dietary intake or dietary status, you'd be fine. It's the self-report that gets us. But dietary vitamin D is only one source of circulating vitamin D. And we know that the other probably more prominent source is sunlight exposure. So that's, you know, and as Chris, as you mentioned, infection status may also affect it. But there, you know, sunlight exposure is correlated with physical activity and age and many other things. So a biomarker is not immune to this structure of potential confounding just because it's objective and not self-report. So measurement error and confounding are two separate issues in observational data.
We should start making people draw the DAGs, the directed acyclic graphs for vitamin D and their outcomes, and having to acknowledge all these different ways that their hypothesis could be wildly confounded.
Maybe we'll put that on our submission requirement. I like that.
Yeah, checklist. All your assumptions.
All right, I have one more paper that I'm just dying to talk about because the study design was just brilliant. And those of us who've been to grad school will really get a chuckle out of it. It is diet and food type affect urinary pesticide residue excretion profiles in healthy individuals, results of a randomized controlled dietary intervention trial. And I learned a lot about this topic by reading this paper. It's a pretty long paper. It addresses the general question of, you know, is it worthwhile spending extra money at Whole Foods? Is that better to buy organic foods? Is it better for your health? Now, it doesn't have any health outcomes, I'll suffice to say. The main outcome of this paper is this urinary residue pesticide excretion measured on a 24-hour urine collection. So organic farming apparently prohibits the use of chemical pesticides, synthetic chemical pesticides, but it does allow for plant-based pesticides and other things. But the whole issue is, well, if you buy organic food, do you have less exposure to these pesticides? And furthermore, and the problem, of course, is that most studies haven't really controlled for environmental exposure to these pesticides, i.e. separate from the diet. So the investigators did a brilliant thing. These 27 healthy adults were, they were doctoral and master's students at the University of Newcastle in the UK, who happened to be performing an agricultural fieldwork study in Crete, Greece, one spring. And so they were recruited, in parentheses or in quotation marks, to this trial. And to account for this environmental exposure of pesticides, and I quote, the 27 participants were first asked to form groups of 2, 3, or 4 who would share a bedroom in the B&B at the student hostel in Greece where they did this study. I kid you not, this was in the pages of our journal. They were then, in a parallel group method, assigned to either standard conventional food, a Mediterranean diet, or an organic food-based Mediterranean diet. And I should mention that before they went to Greece, they were on their standard UK diet, such as it was, based on Western food. So they actually had a number of different points at which they drew blood samples, urine samples, and food samples to assess for pesticide exposure. And very interestingly, table 3 of this paper shows that among several different classes of pesticides, including herbicides, insecticides, and organophosphates, there was substantially lower urinary excretion of these substances when these subjects were on the organic food-based Mediterranean diet as opposed to the standard food Mediterranean diet. And indeed, when they did comparisons of Mediterranean diet, however, it was actually higher in the Mediterranean diet, which is higher in fruits and vegetables, than the Western diet, which was presumably higher in processed foods. So that was kind of a little known, not little known, but, you know, a little tweak at the end of the paper, which is Mediterranean diet has many health benefits, but perhaps pesticide exposure might be something that would be more of a concern. So it's obviously it's a relatively small trial. It was unblinded based on the nature of the intervention, at least the Western versus Mediterranean diet component. But it was really a labor of love for these investigators and a really nice clinical trial.
Did you start buying
Kevin,
more
your
organic food?
Your thoughts?
Did you start Kevin, buying more organic food?
I did.
Does your Whole Foods bill go up?
Yeah, what's the takeaway here?
Well, my takeaway is that you should wash your fruits and vegetables. Because it wasn't clear how much that was done, but
or skip
but indeed,
eating fruits, eat fewer fruits and vegetables, right?
Exposure's
lowest.
I think it seemed to be exposure lowest. What's lacking, of course, and I'd have to do a deeper dive, which is whether these excretion levels are, you know, related to health outcomes or not. But clearly, less is better for you.
Ah, okay. So there, it's weighing at the end the net benefit across these different dietary patterns and what sort of clinical impact this.
Yes. No clinical outcomes are included, but it would be hard for me to say don't eat fruits and vegetables. I would say just wash them well before.
Yeah,
you
I was being facetious.
We need a fruit and vegetable washing trial now to look at these same
outcomes.
Yeah, I think this builds on a lot of concern that folks have. I mean, I know you're kind of poking fun there, Didi, but there is some survey data showing that people, particularly from more low-income communities, will not eat fruit and vegetables out of fear of pesticide residues, because some of the data gets overblown to suggest that foods are even the primary source of pesticide exposure, which is not always true, and that reduction in pesticide exposure is a net health benefit, which I don't also think the weight of the data would say. Avoid all fruits and vegetables to reduce peeing out a little bit more of these pesticides and their metabolites, but it's an interesting topic nonetheless. Hopefully this publication doesn't drive people away from eating a Mediterranean style diet and towards more ultra processed foods. But I would also bet that the levels that are being excreted are not anywhere near the no observable adverse effect levels that are set in toxicological risk assessments. But I also know that the organophosphate literature has been very spicy, and I think the Obama administration, EPA, had wanted to set no acceptable exposure limit. So this is definitely something that will be.
Yeah, I was going to say, are there tolerable limits? I if they are, how are they defined, et cetera? Don't know that.
Yeah, for the organophosphates, I believe that the push has been that there is no acceptable level due to neurodevelopmental outcomes from largely population studies. But I think the tox literature has gone more towards just a very significant precautionary approach of saying we can't define the safest level of exposure, so we shouldn't be using them at all. But most of the literature is from the neurodevelopmental literature comes predominantly from folks living near agricultural areas where they're likely getting pesticide exposure via inhalation and other non-oral routes when from contaminated groundwater. So hopefully people still eat fruits and vegetables despite the pesticide residues, but we'll see. Lots more on that in the upcoming year, I imagine, from folks as, you know, exposure to agrochemicals kind of continues to be a hot topic of concern in the literature and also for the public. Did they measure any residues that are used in organic farming?
They did. They measured copper, which is used in organic farming, and they also, but they weren't, I don't think, able to measure the plant-based pesticide residues.
I know a lot of them rapidly degrade, and the other thing I was going to ask is, did they measure it in the food and any samples of the food that was being fed before?
Yeah, they measured. In fact, their food assays drove them to look for in the blood and urine.
Oh, great! Yeah, so a lot of the issue with all this sort of stuff is there's so much lot-to-lot variability in your exposure that you look at the mean pesticide exposure estimates from things like the Total Diet Study in the U.S. that the FDA does, and the error around it, it's similar to almost like polyphenols, where you look at it and you're like, okay, we could slap a mean value on it, but if you actually look at the variation within a specific food crop category at how much they could provide, like, it's just a massive range for a lot of these. I mean, nutrients have considerable variation in their nutrient content as well across foods, but I think it gets a lot worse for bioactives and pesticides, and it depends on farming practices of where they were grown in that land and what that soil looked like, and becomes very difficult to to legislate around and provide individualized guidance. Because you brought up the copper, that's always the catch-22. People want to go out and they assume that there's risk from conventional, so they run to buy organic. And then you look at the like Consumer Reports and the other watchdogs that put out like where you're getting the heaviest, the most heavy metal exposure. And it's always like rice and beans from some organic product or something with like a brown rice powder that is organic that always seems to be the highest in heavy metals.
So you're saying I should choose organic Oreos?
Yeah, best of both worlds. Yeah. Organic and not a Mediterranean diet approved thing.
Yeah, so skip the fruits and veg, add to the organic ultra processed foods.
I would like to plug that this podcast is not healthcare advice and should not be perceived as healthcare advice, and you should talk to your...
That was dripping in sarcasm that could not be conveyed.
Okay, before we single-handedly ruin the dietary patterns of America, let's move on from pesticides.
Yeah, should we be fortunate to have that level of platform? So
600, our 600 listeners a month, will their diet quality is going to tank.
They're influential listeners, though. Come on.
Chris, was that a wrap for you?
That's a wrap for me. I've got one in the background, but why don't we switch over to you?
Awesome. Yeah, so I thought that this year provided a lot of different study designs, topics, clinical outcomes of interest. The two that stood out for me were related. They were actually both randomized trials, but really on the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to the evidence-based realm. And you have... for example, the fifth top altmetric score paper was the KetoMed trial from Dr. Gardner and his group at Stanford, who continue to crank out these awesome crossover feeding trials of intermediate outcomes. And this this crossover feeding study provides the food. Everyone sticks around for 12 weeks, switches, and then does the next diet in a random order. And because of this sort of intensive delivery of both intervention and involvement from the participants, of course, these can't be very long term because of funding and logistics and where to even find these people. So with these shorter term studies, we are limited almost always, especially in the chronic disease realm, to studying surrogate endpoints. And in this case, they recruited patients with prevalent prediabetes or type 2 diabetes with the primary outcome of HbA1c. And hemoglobin A1c is a marker of glycemic control. So you want that lower if you have type 2 diabetes because it reflects you're within range more. You're not having these drastic increases or excursions that are sustained. You're able to manage your intake and match insulin better, or as we see here, control it with diet where you may not need as much insulin or as tight of control because you're simply not intaking as much carbohydrate. And HbA1c, this clinical marker that's used, is a strong predictor of microvascular complications in patients with diabetes. So poor control or higher levels of HbA1c have been related to blindness, amputation, and a number of these downstream longer-term complications that are really unfortunate and detrimental and costly in patients with diabetes. Whether HbA1c is related to macrovascular, so this high risk of cardiovascular disease we see in patients with type 2 diabetes, is a little bit less certain. And then all-cause mortality and just overall longer length of life and risk of other major chronic diseases that we see patients with diabetes having risk of. So this is a surrogate outcome in the sense you can measure it rather acutely over the course of a month or two. Fasting glucose and insulin, lipids, and liver function and body weight were also measured. So really we're getting a picture of what improvements, if any, these patients are experiencing on either of these diets. And also, because these patients were being delivered their meals, you're able to get really prescriptive and precise about what the intervention is. We're not telling them, you know, eat X amount of grains and protein and whatever and hoping they stick to it. With some variability in your population, we're really able to get it down to the exact formulation that we're hoping to intervene on. So because of that, the authors could contrast to relatively similar diets. And by similar, I mean that these were both healthy diets. And the objective was not to say, is keto good for you? But if we have two relatively healthy low-carb diets, where we have eliminated what we all would assume would be unhealthy, like added sugars, refined grains, non-starchy vegetables. If we're able to kind of even the playing ground there with the big obvious factors, but then really just kind of tweak and compare a few other factors to see, are there any benefits, greater benefits to one of these diets versus the other? This is something that I think these feeding trials are really, really good at. So they were able to look at legumes, fruit, and whole intact grains, which would be a part of a healthy diet in many circles. Others might argue that in diabetes, all of these would be something to avoid because they do contain carbohydrates. So having a diet where you have an even playing field when it comes to added sugar, refined grains, and what we would probably all agree to be unhealthy for a patient with diabetes, is there an additional benefit of being even more restricted in carbohydrates? So that's this ketogenic diet. So we have whole food ketogenic versus this Mediterranean low carb. And we see that everybody improved over the course of the 12 weeks on either diet. And there weren't any striking differences, especially with their primary outcome of HbA1c between the two. This tells us that, you know, if we're a low carb, having this additional further restriction of not consuming legumes, whole grains, and fruits because they contain carbs, even though some might think of them as healthy, there's no added benefit in terms of this intermediate marker of HbA1c. Body weight was similar, lipids were similar, and overall, there wasn't one diet that seemed to be more optimal than the other. There was, however, a difference in LDL, so the part of our cholesterol that's implicated in cardiovascular disease. So LDL increased on the keto diet and compared to the Mediterranean low-carb diet, which saw a nominal decrease. So that kind of increase in one group, decrease in the other was a significant difference between the two. And so this trial is, I think, a good example of what we can do with these short-term feeding trials or feeding studies. At the very other end of the spectrum are these, you know, trials that we see in the pharmaceutical and other intervention literature where you're giving either a placebo control or sham intervention versus, you know, surgery or whatever it might be, and following your patients for many, many years for hard clinical endpoints. It's difficult to do, as you can imagine. Having this exact trial I just discussed continue for years and years would be extremely costly. You'd have a very specific answer to one very specific exposure with a million more remaining questions. So these are not very common in diet, but we did have a published study this year that did kind of check a lot of those boxes, and that's the COSMOS trial. So COSMOS is a factorial, so you have two interventions at the same time, placebo-controlled vitamin or supplement intervention trial. And the COSMOS trial broke into the number 3 and 15 spots in our altmetric scores. So they published two papers simultaneously, one with their cocoflavanol, so that was one of the exposures results, and the other with their multivitamin, that was the other exposure results. And so that trial, now we're looking at decades of literature with multivitamin interventions and placebo-controlled cocoflavanol interventions for a million surrogate endpoints. And here we have, okay, well, what if we followed them long enough? And here we go. We have that answer for cardiovascular disease and cancer in older adults. What do these interventions show if we actually followed them up long enough? And with all of the caveats of adherence and compliance long-term, long-term is still only 3.6 years. So cancer, we know, takes many sites, take decades to develop. Here we have relatively null findings from both of the main outcomes for these exposures. So no significant overall risk reduction for cardiovascular disease with the cocoflavanols, and multivitamin was not related to lower risk of total cancer or cardiovascular disease. So I think it's really interesting because if you look at the literature that these trial, the COSMOS in particular was based on, you see all sorts of surrogate benefits where you would hypothesize that there would be a benefit for cancer and cardiovascular disease. And you, I think we just have to kind of admit to ourselves, we can't call it a closed case just because we see an improvement in HbA1c, for example, or inflammation or lipids. I think we need to have confidence that improving HbA1c or improving inflammation will actually translate to the clinical outcome we think it will. So that was a lot, but I think there's that theme across the trials where you see these short-term, incredibly precise and well-characterized versus long-term, maybe quite a bit less control, but really getting you those clinical endpoints that you ultimately need from a public health perspective.
Thanks for that summary of really three great trials that we published this past year. Back to the Gardner paper was really quite a lot of work in the middle of a global pandemic. And they bring this point up in their discussion where they say, yeah, we were stuck, people were sheltering in place, and they made what seems to me heroic measures to get the intervention to the people, to help them self-report weights. They couldn't do blood pressure. They got to blood drawing places because hemoglobin A1C was, as you point out, their primary outcome variable. So hats off to the team to work through a pandemic and minimize loss to follow-up, which was a lot of work. So great efforts.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. It's a lot of work getting people in even now after the pandemic for a trial I'm conducting, and it's hard. Yeah, clinics were closed too. I'm sure they had to make a lot of workarounds.
Well, and don't forget, we did a whole podcast with Dr. Gardner and his postdoc, Dr. Landry, about keto meds. So you can dive into all the little nuances of how to deliver that intervention, struggles of doing crossover trials and delivering food. And Dr. Landry had a great little secondary paper on adherence measures because it was, I think we're in the era of more food delivery, but that's not quite a controlled feeding trial. And so adherence is better, but I think there's pretty striking, at least from what we can assess, as best we can assess it, pretty striking differences in adherence still. And, you know, which is what you'd expect. People are very difficult to control their intake, even when you're giving them free food. And especially when you're doing ketogenic diets where you're trying to like send them, I think, glassfuls of olive oil and tell them how to utilize it in their diet, which can be quite challenging to do. COSMOS, though, was super interesting, and I know you're describing it as mostly like null outcomes, but I think it was sort of like right on the edge of the effect estimates were all driving towards reduced risk, but didn't quite clear our p-value threshold of 0.05. Was something around 0.1?
So close.
Yeah. It was something very, very close, and kind of gets back to, I think, last year's statistical statement of really the ASN journals published together, really arguing to not use the 0.05 as some sort of like, yeah,
magic
measure. Yeah, there's nothing happens at 0.051 versus 0.049 that suddenly makes something clinically meaningful. And so I think, you know, I applaud that the nutraceuticals space is finally moving beyond. You know, this is a type of intervention where we can reasonably randomize folks to it in a blinded manner and mirror the pharmaceutical trial designs where you can have hard endpoints. And the nutraceutical space has avoided that, investing in that kind of design for quite a long time. And so it was interesting to see cocoflavanols kind of get tested in this way. And I think the data was promising from when you look at the entirety of the surrogate outcomes. I don't think based off the COSMOS trial, there's going to be many cardiovascular guidelines that are recommending cocoflavanol supplementation. But the fact that it approached, that they have a standardized product that's been invested in and they have at least one cardiovascular endpoint trial that depending on, I think there was a subgroup analysis, right, of like adherence to the taking the supplement did cross the statistical threshold for significance. So curious.
Yeah, and some of the sub outcomes.
Some of the secondary outcomes. Yeah.
So the power of clinical trials is driven, of course, by the number of events that the investigators anticipate they would observe over the course of their follow-up. And this can be done in a number of ways a priori. First, by enrolling specifically higher risk participants or patients into the study, so you don't have to enroll as many, and follow-up might not have to be for as long because that number of events or that event rate would be quite a bit higher than, for example, just enrolling the general population. But if we're enrolling the general population, or those maybe perhaps just based on being in a particular age group, but otherwise healthy for primary prevention, then the anticipated event rate is, you know, something that can be estimated from what you might expect in the general population. Of course, those that enroll in clinical trials do tend to be somewhat healthier than the general population or have other characteristics different. So it's a guessing game to some degree. And the other strategy for anticipating more events would be to expand what you're defining as your outcome. So we see this a lot in cardiovascular trials where the outcome might be total cardiovascular disease. And this might be a large or rather broad composite endpoint where it's really all comers, stroke, cardiovascular disease, and death from either of these events, as well as any of these elective procedures such as PCI or CABG, that would indicate an individual might have cardiovascular disease, but have elected to a procedure rather than experienced an event like an MI or stroke. So when we have these composite endpoints, this allows us to accrue more events quickly. And this is, you know, definitely important for optimizing, you know, cost, risk, and benefits of designing a trial. But in the end, if the specific pathophysiology of your intervention is for one specific type of cardiovascular disease, then you might actually end up hurting your power at the end of the trial because you're diluting it with all of these, potentially irrelevant or less related outcomes. So in the COSMOS trial, we see total cardiovascular events, which is, again, this composite catch-all endpoint, was nominally borderline statistically significant. And we can say, you know, that doesn't matter or that it's borderline and therefore we should pay attention to it. But if you look further down in their figure two, for example, where they kind of give all of the various endpoints by themselves and other combinations of them, you can see that, you know, MI and stroke actually were pretty similar. But for the more elective procedures like CABG and PCI and those that are more difficult to diagnose, such as angina and carotid artery disease, where these aren't events, but really rely on individuals interacting with their healthcare system, there may be sources of measurement error or bias happening. There's very little relationship of the randomized cocoflavital intervention with those endpoints. And it's really the hard events that we see being related to the intervention. So their very last data point in figure two, which is major cardiovascular. So these are these harder endpoints of MI, stroke, or death from either of these that we do see a statistically significant lower risk for. So for those who are driven by p-values, when some of these, grayer area type endpoints, elective procedures are removed, we see that this is actually a significant finding. But then there's the debatable, why don't we just do major cardiovascular disease or just the hard endpoints? And of course, that would be, if we can predict that we would get enough of those events, that probably would be favorable. But it's just a little bit of a guessing game a priori when a design is being put together for a trial in terms of how many participants need to be enrolled, what's the follow-up time, how many events do we anticipate having. There is that guessing game or a little bit of a trade-off there from having your primary endpoint be this really broad composite versus a really targeted but many fewer events endpoint. So that's, that's always under consideration when these trials are designed. And I think it's important to pay attention beyond just that primary endpoint, which sometimes is, comes down to a tough decision that the investigator had to make to choose one. That was the COSMOS trial.
But good for them for being true to their primary outcome design and making it very clear that what was stated in the paper was consistent with their a priori hypotheses.
Yeah, and obviously, hopefully they fund several other trials so that we can have the power to meta-analyze these and see if any of these things really stick out. And this is such a common thing in the nutrition and chronic disease endpoint literature that we've explored with omega-3s, particularly. You look at every single trial, and there's almost always a primary composite CVD endpoint that's null, and then individual subcategories that are some sort of benefit. And then I don't think the meta-analysis has been as kind to omega-3s for a bunch of reasons, but flavanols, at least, the cocoflavanols, you're so dwarfing background exposure and don't really have an endogenous level of them that they get rapidly kind of excreted. And so I think they bypass a lot of the issues with nutrients as far as a food-derived compound goes. But I don't think we're anywhere close. I guess this gets into like sort of a nutraceutical space too, and not really a nutritional exposure at some point, because you would have to eat quite a bit of cocoa beans with quite a bit of calories and fiber and a whole bunch of other things to get to the levels. Yeah, cool. Well, I think we had a good year, and that's a great kind of overview. I don't want to, I'll try and post a link to the altmetrics and top-cited articles, because we had a lot of really interesting commentaries about feeding behavior still, and some more on vitamin D and Mendelian randomization. And there was a lot of Mediterranean diet stuff looking at things like less common, not cardiometabolic disease, but getting into depression, which I thought was kind of interesting, and brain atrophy. So I think probably in 2023, we will continue to see neurocognitive and just neurological kind of outcomes in general take center stage as that becomes more of a hot topic to study, and some more cohorts have included. I think several years ago, people had started to include neurocognitive assessments, and that we are now seeing the end results of that with trials being completed and lots to stay. I think that I'm actually excited about that kind of stuff, because I think it's at least some sort of a meaningful functional endpoint for patients that they can act on, as opposed to just being like, well, my HbA1c dropped 0.3 points and I don't feel any different, but good to know numbers are tracking downwards. So if you actually can, we can say, you have a quality of life benefit. That's always a nice thing that I think the nutrition literature has not engaged with as much as it should have. So I will post a link to that for sure. Cool. All right. Any final closing thoughts? We're coming up on an hour here, which is perfect.
Just happy new year to all of our readers and listeners, and look forward to 2023.
I'd really like to thank all the reviewers. I think it's incredibly difficult to find them, as many editors and journals and even peer reviewers know. But at the end of the day, it's what we rely on for academic science in the current, atmosphere and how things are, and having experts weigh in and be that super thorough reviewer is amazing for us editors, because we can pass these on to the authors and those who are trying to get their papers published to improve the field overall. And I think nutrition science in particular, because it is so diverse in terms of the talent and expertise across these different types of research objectives and studies, we really, really need reviewers and what they have to say to be able to keep going. And it makes our field better to be able to have that rigor and that review process. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you to all of our authors and peer reviewers and podcast guests and Twitter interactors, most of you. You all make our jobs possible, and we look forward to 2023 and continuing over at Elsevier. So it'll be interesting to see how that change goes.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Dee Dee.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you soon.